have police photographing our license plates.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. My guest today is Scott Bond, PhD. He's a criminology professor at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. Welcome to the program, Scott Bond. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And how are you?
I'm great. I've got a head cold and a little throat thing going, so I hope that doesn't distract too much. But I'm fascinated with what I know about Scott Bond, he's written a book called Why We Love Serial Killers. Now, I must admit, when I first saw that, I reached out to Scott and said, I've got to have you on the show, because if there's one thing I've been dying to know, it's why we love serial killers. Can you give us a hint? What's the appeal?
Absolutely. And, of course, the title is a bit ironic. We don't love them per se, but through my teaching and my research and working with students, it's become very apparent to me that there is a fascination with serial killers.
Yes.
And that's really what this book is about. And the fascination takes different forms. You know, there's an aspect of it that is about the why, the motivations of serial killers, because they do such extreme, horrible things. It's very difficult for the average person to comprehend how kidnap complete strangers, torture, kill, mutilate, do the terrible things that serial killers do. So there's certainly a fascination with the criminal mind and this extreme behavior. And also there's the fact that they're so rare, that serial killers represent about 1% of all homicides in the United States. And fortunately, homicide has been going down, as I'm sure you know, for a number of years.
Yes.
And serial killing has been going down as well. But consistently, serial killers represent about 1% of all homicides. So I use the analogy that serial killers are almost like the human form of a great white shark. They're rare, they're exotic, and they're very deadly.
Yes.
And we celebrate a Shark Week.
Yes.
We have Shark Week.
Yes.
I don't know whether a serial killer week is down the road here, but I think there is a similar fascination with these larger than life predators. So those are a couple of the, I think, very important reasons.
So we make celebrities out of monsters. I mean, we make other celebrities too, of course, but Al Capone, I think it's safe to say, and many of our American gangsters were serial killers, although their primary goal was to simply make money, and if you got in their way, then you became part of a series of murders, I guess, but that wasn't their primary goal. But with serial killers, I presume that you're talking about, I mean, these are people, as you say, that's their intention, that's their goal in life, that's what they live for. But there are a lot of myths about serial killers. What do you tell us about the myths of serial killers, the facts?
Well, yes, that's a great question, and I devoted an entire chapter, it's the second chapter of my book, to debunking a number of myths about serial killers.
Uh-huh.
The standard stereotype or myth about serial killers is that they're all dysfunctional, relatively young white males who live in isolation. And the epitome of that would be Buffalo Bill in the movie Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, yeah.
Or perhaps the Tooth Fairy in the prequel Red Dragon.
Yes.
Would be another example. But it's really really not true. Serial killers come, first of all, in both genders. About 15 to 20% of all serial killers are actually women.
Wow.
Which most people are completely unaware of.
Yes.
And that's because we focus on the terrible acts of male serial killers who typically kill female victims. But you have someone like Eileen Wuornos, who was the highway prostitute and serial killer who was brought to infamy in the movie Monster.
Yes.
By Charlize Theron.
That's right.
And she won an Academy Award for that.
Yes.
She's probably the most well-known female serial killer because of that movie, but she's certainly not alone.
Yes.
There were at least 100 female serial killers throughout the 20th century. They simply don't receive the same level of media attention that males do, and one of the reasons is because female serial killers tend to kill in less extreme and bloody ways.
Uh-huh.
A female serial killer typically is more likely to poison her victims, is more likely to work in a retirement home or a hospital and kill patients,
and
sometimes exploit them for their insurance money, that sort of thing.
Yes.
You've heard of the Black Widow?
Oh, yes.
That's the Black Widow sort of killer, right?
Yes, yes.
So I actually argue in my book that the reason that Eileen Wuornos got so much attention by the media, and they made it into a movie, is because she killed like a man.
Yes.
She used a gun and she blazed her, you know, her way to glory, so to speak.
Yes.
Or infamy. So that's one. You know, there are definitely female serial killers, and there are serial killers of every race and ethnicity as well.
Well,
they're not all white.
You know, this sounds twisted, but I'm going to ask it anyway. We know in society that women are treated differently and paid less, not even constitutionally equal, for that matter. We bring up ERA to mind, etc. And that the minorities are also not treated with equal respect and equality in other ways. And are you telling me that even those who, women and minorities that kill people aren't treated equally by the press, the media, or the public either?
Absolutely, and I make this argument in my book. I've worked in the media industry for over 20 years, actually, before I became a criminologist.
Uh-huh.
And began studying crime. So I became very aware of the way news is fashioned, and there tends to be, and it's unfortunate, but it's nevertheless true.
Yeah.
A disproportionate amount of media attention given to crimes where the victim is a young, attractive, white female. And this is often the case. It's the same thing with serial killers. See, there's one of the other myths that I debunk is this notion that murder or homicide and serial killing as well is interracial. You know, a lot of people think that whites kill blacks, mm-hmm. blacks kill whites, and that's because of some of the media attention given to, like, Trayvon Martin, you know, those
yes.
sort of cases. But the reality is, the real reality is that whites typically kill whites, blacks typically kill blacks, Latinos kill Latinos. That's the reality. And the cases that tend to get the most attention is where you have a white serial killer killing young, attractive white women. Those are the cases that become high profile, that get all the media attention, and that's what leads us to think that all serial killers are young, white men, and it's just not true.
You know, even though I've heard of the Black Widow, and of course they've made two or three films about her and other movies, you're absolutely right, because if you think about it and really look into it, there is no gender gap or racial divide or whatever in what makes up a serial killer. So then one has to ask, okay, if it can be male or female, black or white or Hispanic or whatever, what drives the serial killer? I mean, we certainly have examples. I think most of them that come off the top of my head are white males, but like the Son of Sam. I mean, where do these people come from? Or the Boston Strangler?
Again, these are really wonderful questions, and I devote a couple of chapters to the motivations and fantasies and so on of these individuals in my book. And I actually, in preparation for my book, because I wanted to go to the source,
yes.
I wanted to try to ascertain the motivations and what really drove these individuals. So I corresponded with and interviewed David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, extensively.
Uh-huh.
I actually spent 5 hours with him in prison.
Okay.
And I also corresponded extensively over several years with Dennis Rader, who called himself Buying Torture Kill, who's just a true narcissist and psychopath. And I got tremendous insights from them. And in the case of Dennis Rader, Buying Torture Kill,
yes.
his pseudonym that he gave save himself, bind, torture, kill,
yes,
pretty much says it all. That was his need. He had a need to capture, to tie up, to torture individuals, and then slowly strangle them and kill them. And for him, it was, the motivations were all about domination and control. It was about capturing these people, controlling them, and he said, in his words, he says, "I was God. I decided when they would live or die." And that is a true psychopath. And
wow.
You can't put it more emphatically than that. And he really has no remorse whatsoever. He's completely unabashed in his claim that he's a natural-born killer, and sees himself that way. In fact, this talk about narcissism and egomania, he's actually created, we're talking about Dennis Rader here,
yes,
his own prison logo. He signs his letters to me, and I'm sure others, Dennis, but Dennis is signed, he draws it in the shape of a shark. So that pretty much tells you how he sees himself. He sees himself like a shark.
Okay. This is fascinating, Doctor. I want now, because we hear these words all the time, but let's not assume anything. Can you define narcissism or a narcissistic person to us?
Yeah. A narcissist is an individual who basically sees the world through their own eyes.
Uh-huh.
Everything is about them. And so in the case of Dennis, individuals were just objects. The people served only for his amusement. He couldn't have normal relationships with people. There was no empathy. There was no emotional connection.
Mm.
They were simply toys for his amusement. So it's all about him. A narcissist is everything is, he's the center of his own universe, and that's true narcissistic personality. Now, when you combine that with psychopathy, a psychopath,
mm-hmm,
which Dennis Rader is, then you really have the makings of a killing machine, because a psychopath has no feeling.
Yes.
He's completely unable to sympathize or empathize with others. So when he would torture and kill, it meant nothing more to him than it was just an exercise. He might as well have been putting together a model airplane, because it had no more emotional effect on him than that. He called his victims simply, they were interesting projects to work on.
Oh, my God. Well, that certainly brings us back to the great white shark. Goodness. All right. Well, this is fascinating, and I'm so glad you came on the show. We do want to let people know how they can buy your book, so get your pens and papers out. We'll do that at the end of the show, if not at the end of both segments. We're talking to Dr. Scott Bond about why we love serial killers, why we're fascinated with making monsters into celebrities. So tell us about, my goodness, you had conversations with the son of Sam. What was that like?
That was a very different experience than with Dennis Rader.
Uh-huh.
David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, has been incarcerated now for 37 years.
Yes.
The Summer of Sam, which it became known as,
yes,
infamously, 1977. So he's now been locked up more than half of his life. He was a young man when he committed his crimes. And he has been, and I'm using his words now, I'm describing it as he told me, he has been spiritually transformed.
Uh-huh.
He actually refers himself now as the Son of Hope. He claims that in, I believe it was 1986,
mm-hmm,
that one night, he fell on his knees in his prison cell, and he said he was touched by the hand of God because he could no longer survive. He wanted to die, and he said that God came to him that night and took away his pain and forgave him. And David Berkowitz now is totally committed to serving God in whatever way he can behind bars. Now, what form does that take? Well, he actually, this is incredible, it's
uh-huh,
the truth is stranger than fiction, David Berkowitz has been embraced by the evangelical Christian community, or at least portions of it, and he has a website, which is called riseandshine.org, and this website has been accessed all over the world by a couple hundred thousand 30,000 people now who claim to be inspired by his message of transformation and spiritual rebirth. So it's, you know, this is just an incredible odyssey,
yes,
if you will. And he actually works in, he's in Sullivan Correctional Facility, which is in the Catskills in New York, upstate.
Yes.
And it's very isolated. He is basically in a prison with very disturbed other inmates, most of them lifers like him.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually helps his fellow inmates. He works in the chapel. He works in the hospital. He serves as a mobility guide for prisoners who have physical problems. And he tries to help any way he can. And he writes letters all over the world to cancer patients and people who seem to be inspired by his story. So, you know, I spent 5 hours with him.
Yes.
Sitting with him in prison, and we had lunch and talked, and he insisted on praying with me and hugging me, and it was really kind of a, you know, just an amazing experience. And people ask me all the time if I take him, you know, seriously, do I believe in it? And I'll tell you this, if David Berkowitz is not serious, then he is the Daniel Day-Lewis actor of serial killers, because he sat and wept in front of me as he talked about his crimes, and he said, I would do anything to undo the harm and pain that I've caused. And he knows people scoffed at this. He knows people just believe that, you know, he's doing this for his own purposes, but he really has nothing to gain. He is never going to be paroled, and
yes,
he knows that. And he doesn't get an extra portion of chocolate pudding on Saturday night for doing good work or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
So I take it at face value. I'm really practical about this. He's right where he belongs.
Uh-huh.
If he helps one person in some way and helps one person with their own struggles, then I say let him do it for the rest of his life.
Well, that's far better than being on the street or than some of the horrible things that can happen to one in prison. I'm a big believer in transformation. It happens. I mean, we need only go back to Saul becoming Paul and other incidents. But as you say, as long as he's staying in prison, I feel a little more comfortable with that. Still, it is a fascinating story.
It really is. And I devoted an entire chapter to his journey in my book because I found it so really moving in many ways.
Yes. It is. I mean, I'm sitting here moved by it. That's the word. My mind spins, I guess, as I try to put that whole picture into one place and then label it. And that's probably the challenge for not someone like yourself who spent time actually talking with, having conversations with serial killers, and now writing such an in-depth study. It's probably not as difficult to embrace the all the possibilities, but I'm sure I'm not alone in going, how do you, I wasn't going to say this, but I will now, how do you sleep at nights? How do you go to bed after writing a chapter?
Well, that's also a really good question, and my students ask me the same thing. And you know, I'm a social scientist. I'm a criminologist. This is what I do. This
yes.
is my work. And you have to have a certain detachment from it, a professional detachment. Just as a homicide detective who may be out chasing the Son of Sam
yes.
or BTK has to be able to detach from it, I have to be able to do the same thing. But I will, let's put it this way. I don't think that I would be able to work with these individuals day in and day out, say the way a prison guard does. I frankly don't think I could do that work. But I do find it intellectually very, very interesting, and I'm curious too. I mean, why I wrote this book, because I'm one of the people who wants to know why are we captivated by these folks? You know, there's an aspect of it that we didn't really talk about yet. That you know, these individuals give us an adrenaline rush. You know, when we're kids, or at least I'll speak for myself. When I was a kid, I loved fun houses and going to horror movies,
yes.
monster movies, Frankenstein, all that. I love to have the bejesus scared out of me when I was a little kid.
Excuse me, Scott, we're going to stop right there and take a break. It'll be a great place to come back. Fun houses and horror movies. We'll be right back with Scott Bond, PhD, professor of criminology, who has written Why We Love Serial Killers. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Here's one from the treasure chest. John Sayles' 1987 drama, Mate Juan. Sayles was one of the originals, before we'd even heard the term independent film. Working with little money and loads of passion, he's uninterested in gimmickry, preferring substance over style. He tells simple stories about complex characters, making irresolvable moral choices. Mate Juan is a classic struggle between the haves and the have-nots, the powerful and the powerless. It's an ambitious story of miners, victimized by their corporate masters. When a union organizer comes to town, they strike, simply seeking livable conditions. They soon come into conflict with the notorious Baldwin Felts Detective Agency, hired by the Stone Mountain Coal Company. The resulting deadly shootout was the trigger for the Great Coalfield War and the infamous Battle of Blair Mountain, where air power was used for the first time against American citizens. At its core, Mate Juan is the story of the downtrodden standing up against corporate masters at a time when corporations are free from the restraints of government control. There are brilliant performances in this indie gem. Chris Cooper's film debut as the fictional union organizer Joe Kenahan, and James Earl Jones as Few Clothes Johnson, one of his most powerful film roles ever, and he's had more than a few. Mate Juan is a treasure not to be missed. Indie Film Minute, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is Professor Scott Bahn, professor of criminology at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. He has written Why We Love Serial Killers, and in the process has sat down with the likes of the Son of Sam and, now the other name has gone out of my head. Who was the other one that the psychopath that you mentioned so much the last segment?
Yes. Called himself Dying, Torture, Kill.
Yes, and there are others to talk about, including Ted Bundy. But first, we want to pick up where we would, where the good PhD was taking us, Scott. yes. So when you were a kid, you liked horror movies. Now I loved the fun houses. I loved spooky, scary things. I loved Twilight Zone, and I loved, I guess, more thrillers than horrors. And I get upset with Netflix and streaming when they don't seem to know the difference between a horror film and a thriller. But be that as it may, you say, because when I saw The Blob, the first one, I was a kid, and man, I was, that thing kept me awake for a good while. But tell us, what gave you that adrenaline rush that you enjoyed the horror films even as a kid?
Yes, well, I think that this is a very, very common phenomenon. You know, as kids, we love all of that. We love roller coasters, you know, that
yes.
scare the heck out of us.
Yes.
And the reason is this. It's actually, you can explain it through science. And that is, it gives us an adrenaline rush.
Yes.
And adrenaline is euphoric, you know. It
yes.
It charges up. It gets our heart racing. It's a high. You know,
yes.
Adrenaline
yes.
gives us the high. And I argue, and I really believe this, that just as monster movies and fun houses give an adrenaline rush to kids, I think serial killers, in a way, offer the same thing to us as adults. They get the heart racing, there's a visceral appeal to it. We get excited. And this, I believe that this happens in both fact and fiction. If you read about the exploits of a serial killer in the news,
yes.
and for example, there was one very high profile here in New York, the Long Island serial killer, a couple of years ago, who has still not been caught, has not been apprehended,
oh,
as far
yes.
as we know. And that individual kept people on the edge of their seats for better than a year, tuning in every day on the news and looking in newspapers for the latest episode of what was happening. And it gives you that, you know, that fear factor. And the same thing is true in fiction. People love Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs has now been brought back as a hit TV show on NBC, Hannibal, which
oh, yes.
is the early years exploits
yes.
of Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
You've got The Following on Fox about serial killers. You have The Killing on AMC. We have all of these shows dedicated to serial killers, and for the same reason, they scare the heck out of us, whether they're fact or fiction. So it's, I say it's a form of popcorn entertainment, and the way that serial killers are presented in the news media and entertainment. It's very similar. They're presented as these stylized monsters. They're oftentimes referred to as vampires and ghouls and evil madmen, monsters. Those are the kind of terms that are used in fictionalized accounts as well as real, you know, news accounts. So there's a blurring, I believe, of fact and fiction to the point or to the extent that the serial killer in fact and fiction has become just a form of entertainment. And we love them in the movies, we love them in the, you know, reading about their true crime accounts. And unless Jeffrey Dahmer comes knocking at your front door or Ted Bundy, then it becomes very real. But until then, it's just a source of entertainment, I believe.
As you said that, I realized I was an avid viewer of The Following and The Killing. I thought both were exceptional. And I didn't even think about it. I just loved it. Oh, well, gee. Well, my wife loves Hannibal Lecter, but I love Anthony Hopkins. I do believe there's a difference. And I make that distinction.
And another one, let's not forget, that was on last year that I thought was really terrific, was True Detective on HBO.
That's right. That's right. There's one I don't watch. I love it, but I don't watch it just before going to bed, only because it is so good and it's analytical. And now I'm trying to think of what it is. It's not that new, but it's streaming on Netflix, and it's about a team of profilers, and they are able to find out the killer of these gruesome murders, and they're serial killers primarily. Can't think of the name of the show now, but it is. I guess I am fascinated. I'm one of those people you're writing about. Not the killers, but the ones fascinated by them. Okay.
And if I wanted to add, if you think about it, all of these TV shows dedicated to serial killers and the profiling of serial killers, the agents who create them and so forth, once again, it's so disproportionate to the fact that serial killers only represent 1% of all homicides.
Exactly.
But yet, it's that 1% that's so extreme, so over the top, so surreal in many ways that we're just compelled to understand it and fascinated to follow it.
Tell me, what is the difference, if there is any, or similarities to a mass murderer? And I don't just mean an Adolf Hitler. I guess he still wears the crown on that. But I mean someone going into and killing kids in a school or people in a theater. A mass murderer, as opposed to a serial killer, what's the distinction?
Cooling off period is so important because because it gets to the psychology or the pathology of these individuals that this is something that is a compulsion. It's an ongoing need, and even though they seem to have normal lives, they periodically, and this cool-off period can vary. It could be a couple of weeks. It could be months. In some instances, it's even years. BTK, bind, torture, kill, actually, when some of his killings were separated by years in between. And what happens is, and I can describe it, but I can't fully explain it because it gets to the psychopathic mind, but something overwhelms them. They become absolutely compelled and obsessed to kill, and when it happens, they can't control it, and they go out and kill again.
Goodness. Why was 1974 the year of the serial killer?
Great question. And, 1974, you had some of the most prolific and high-profile serial killers of all time operating. You had Ted Bundy, who in many ways is sort of the poster boy of all serial killers. You had BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill, was operating that year. Another infamous serial killer was John Wayne Gacy, known as the Killer Clown. He was operating that year. And we also had a rare high-profile, but nevertheless, he was probably the best well-known of all African-American serial killers, and that was Carl Eugene Watts, who called himself, he didn't call himself, he was referred to by the media as the Sunday Morning Slasher. And so these individuals were all operating the same year.
Wow.
Received tremendous media attention, and a couple of things led to, why I call this the year of the serial killer. One is 1974 is the year that the FBI formed their behavioral science unit in Quantico for the purpose of studying serial predators. So that was the year they set it up. Also that year, one of the legendary FBI profilers, Robert Ressler, may he rest in peace, he died about a year and a half ago,
yes,
came up with the term serial killer. Prior to 1974, they were generally referred to as mass murderers, but the distinction was made in 1974. So you had a tremendous amount of media attention given to these individuals. You had the FBI forming their behavioral science unit to study serial killers, and even the term was coined that year. So that's why I refer to it as 74 as the year of the serial killer.
Well, it's disturbing. Have we had such a year like that repeated since?
Well, you've had high-profile serial killers since then, of course.
Yes.
Jeffrey Dahmer and others, the Green River Killer, the Zodiac.
Yes.
I mean, the media tend to pick certain individuals, and oftentimes, as I said, it's related to the fact of killing white female victims.
Yes.
Ted Bundy killed predominantly white female, young white females, at least 36 of them,
yes.
And they even had a particular profile, long dark hair, and so he received just tremendous media attention.
Yes.
A lot of it has to do with the victimology, the type of victim, who becomes a high-profile killer. For example, the Long Island serial killer here in New York was killing predominantly sex workers, prostitutes that he was contacting through Craigslist.
Yes.
I have made the argument, if he had been killing Wall Street executives, this would have been the highest profile case
yes.
of all time.
Yes. And was it John Wayne Gacy? He did teenage boys, right? He was...
That's right. Yes, boys and young men.
Yeah. Yes. You know, I want to ask you something that comes to mind of a personal experience. A few years back, and actually, you will know exactly when I describe why I'm asking the question. I worked at the Kennedy Center for a man, I guess I can say his name. He's long gone now. Dr. Archie Bufkins, who used to say to me he was the token black there. He was an amazing man, a tremendous boss. And I was working for him at the time when the the Atlanta murders were going on. And I never will forget something he said to me, because, you know, everyone was troubled by this. We didn't know. And, you know, that reminds me, too, of the guys more recently in D.C. shooting children and people out of the trunk of a car. But back to the Atlanta murders, Dr. Bufkin said to me, you know, Marcello, the sad thing is this is going to be a black person, the murderer, because there's no way a white person could walk into those neighborhoods and be able to get to children in that way. What are your thoughts, and whatever happened to that case? It just seemed to disappear, evaporate or something.
Yeah. Well, he's absolutely right. And it gets back to the fact that homicide of all sorts, individual murders, serial murders, and even mass murders for that matter, typically are intra-racial, meaning the same race killing their own race,
yes.
and as opposed to interracial. And the fact that this was a black man killing black children, the case it received media attention. It was a national story,
yes.
But it was not the size of national story that it would have been, I believe, very firmly, if it was a white man killing white children.
And that's
a sad statement, but I believe that it's absolutely true. A lot of these cases are not, they're just not treated equally. They just aren't. It has a lot to do with the victimology. You know, in the case of prostitutes who are frequently victims because they're easy prey for serial killers,
yes.
They don't tend to receive as much attention as if the victims are even so-called decent people. You know, if
yes.
They're so-called decent people, then they receive, you know, tend to receive more notoriety. Now, as far as the Atlanta child murders, they caught the individual they believe who was responsible for that case, but there's still a little bit of question whether the same individual committed all of the murders, and whether they ultimately had the right individual, kind of like the Boston Strangler. You know,
yes.
About that as well.
Well, this has been something. Before we go, though, I of course do want to talk about how we can get a hold of your book. Now that I've spoken to you, I really, really want to get a hold of it. I did want to ask you, though, about, because I've been in New York most of my adult life as a director of theater and on soap operas. And I, because of medical reasons, my parents' medical reasons, left New York pretty much. I'm back and forth between New York and D.C. a great deal. But when I knew I was going to be in the Northern Virginia area for a while, I wanted to be doing something. And I got a job in a school. I did drama and theater there, and said all that to set up that during that time, the 9/11 happened, and also these two guys who were shooting people from the backs of their cars. You know, everyone's terrified to walk the streets or get pump gasoline. We know we captured them, and one was dominated by the other, etc. What prompted these guys? There seemed to be no rhyme or reason.
Yeah, Malvo and Mohammed.
Yes.
Right? And that, by the way, that was considered a spree killing. And what a spree killing is where there are multiple crime scenes and killings, but in a very truncated short period of time. So it's not spread out like a serial killer. There's no cooling off period.
Yes.
These guys had an agenda, they had a mission, and they were doing it very quickly within a short, I forget what the duration was, but it was a couple of weeks, I believe,
that
all of these shootings took place. And they eventually, of course, caught them. It apparently, Mohammed dominated his younger associates.
Yes.
These are not the exact ages, but they were roughly like 45 and 20.
Yes, something like that, yes.
Ages. So definitely Mohammed had Malvo under his thumb and controlled him. Mohammed, apparently, there was a rage and anger toward his wife, and there was some motivation there. But I don't think that they ever clearly identified a specific motivation
yes.
for this, that they had a specific agenda. But Mohammed definitely was angry at his ex-wife. That much has been determined.
Well, I have to tell you, he certainly got a lot of schools in the area worked up. I mean, with the closing, sitting in the dark in the cafeteria, the poor kids with all the blinds drawn and everything. It's killing of any kind, serial killing, shooting on the streets, gang violence, all of it. It's a sad thing, and I'm annoyed that the mentally ill get blamed all the time, because sometimes that isn't the excuse, but certainly with serial killers, that's what we've been talking about, psychopaths, etc. That's enough of my talking. Let's now find out, Scott, how do we get a hold of your book, please, or website, or whatever, however we can learn more?
Absolutely. Well, the full title of the book is Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers, and it's easily accessible on Amazon.com. It's available in print. It's available in ebook format or Kindle, as well as there is an audiobook, by the way.
Oh, okay.
It's on the shelves at many bookstores, including Barnes & Noble, and of course you can buy it online there. And if you want to read more about it, I have a website, which is docbonn.com, docbonn.com, and you can read more about the book there. But to purchase it, probably the easiest thing is just go straight to Amazon. And by the way, as we speak, they have a special on Kindle, $1.99. My book is available for $1.99 on Kindle at Amazon.
All right, then. Very good. Well, it has been it's been a thriller, fascinating and mind-boggling and incredibly informative educational conversation with Dr. Scott Bonn, author of Why We Love Serial Killers and the Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. Thank you so much, Scott, for being on the show. It's disturbing, but I certainly am glad we had this conversation and that we had it on the radio. I wish you all the very best, and to you and all your students and all that's important to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. A little Polish film entered indie theaters in 2014 and surprised everyone with its staying power. Ida drew audiences through word of mouth and earned itself a favorite place in the foreign language Oscar race. Under its quiet surface, Ida suggests the universal struggle of mankind to make sense of our existence. This is a world which fights to attain moral goals and leaves behind the detritus of corruption. Ida's journey is our path. A Catholic initiate, Ida's image of self has been formed in a convent. Before taking her vows, she must now learn the secrets of her past. Guided by her deeply savaged aunt, Ida will discover her ancestry and the devastation that made her an orphan. Here we have allegory, vast human truths presented through an individual story. Visually, every frame of this stunning black and white film is worthy of display for the ages, with pearlescent detail emerging effervescent from deep shadow, beauty defined. Ida is contemplation at its best. True, contemplative might be read as warning, boring, boring, but not here. In this case, it is an apt opportunity to consider the state of mankind and our place within it. Mesmerizing. Ida. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Missing you and us, too. There was little reason for my grandmama to leave her huge farm to go into town, a few miles away, for groceries, gasoline, farm equipment, overalls, and newspapers. Now I only go back for the funerals and to hear on the breeze what I've missed. I'm not into romanticizing the past, believing things, for the most part, are always improving, until G.W. and Cheney, of course. As long as what's new doesn't obliterate what's been with what's coming round the bend. I don't miss Mayberry or my slumlord friends on Shelter Island, but I do miss New York City neighborhoods, walking city blocks, and being constantly in rehearsals for something. I miss Gypsy and Heinrich, best and worst watchdogs, respectively. Don't miss Dad and Mom so much as it still feels like they're here. But I do miss people who trim their trees back from power lines, so when the winds come, we keep our AC. I miss hailing a yellow cab for Carol Channing, strolling midtown with Colleen Dewhurst, and chatting with James Whitmore about the next voice you hear. He said I was too young to have seen it, but while other boys my age were outside playing ball, I was watching old movies on TV. Mr. Whitmore was so proud of the fact that he had made the movie with Nancy Reagan before she met Ronnie. But I told him I would never forget what it felt like when God spoke to him on his radio. I miss that. I miss taking time to tune up with morning prayers and reel-to-reel Gregorian chant. I don't miss fast cars and curvy roads, for that's still how I relax. I miss Jimmy Stewart and Harvey, Yul Brynner and the American Original Six, Gregory Peck, whom Mom told, my son is an actor too. I never miss Florida except when I think of hurricanes 250 miles offshore pinning me against the lifeguard chair, streaking back my hair with beach sand, my lips rimmed like a margarita glass, and the ocean some distance away lapping occasionally at my toes, as a seagull above makes no headway because of headwinds. I miss the silence that can only be heard without the din, and I miss people who understand the wisdom in that. I miss Marvin's white boots as much as our drama classes. I miss my voice lessons with Wayne and Ernie, and both the Peabody and Baltimore Opera in the days of George Woodhead and Bill Iannuzzi, the only man who smoked more cigarettes than my 61-year-old brother, just diagnosed with the lungs of an 80-year-old. I miss him already. For me, missing is more happy memories than sad longing. But I do miss not seeing my best friend Lance Thomas Vining. However, I don't miss the Silver Diner, his favorite dining choice. I do miss my annual trips to Europe, but it was a wonderful career that suspended them, so we make our choices. I miss dates on letters, even to find telephone numbers on bills, and I miss sleeping more than 5 hours a night. But most of all, I miss who we were in the 60s. I miss Abraham, Martin, and John, and Bobby, too. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.